We're doing the podcast.
Howdy, y'all! Welcome into South of Scruffy Podcast. I'm Ben Fields. This is my podcast. You're back. We're back. It's good to be back. We've taken a little break since August of 2023, but we have banked some more episodes and put together some more episodes that are going to be coming out here soon. We might not be able to do once a week like we did for 3 years, but we're going to put them out when we can. To make sure that you know when we put out a new episode of South of Scruffy, since it's going to be all over the place, subscribe wherever you're listening right now and turn notifications on. It'll give you a little badge notification when we put out a new episode. There you go. You won't have to check your phone all the time. So, for the first guest back, Tori Olson is here. Tori Olson is an associate professor and director of graduate studies in American history at the University of Tennessee. Tori's most recent book, Red Dead's History, A Video Game, An Obsession, and America's Violent Past, is coming out in August of 2024. And you can actually go ahead and pre-order that book, which I would highly recommend. There is a link in the episode description where you can pre-order the book. This was a wonderful chat and one of my favorites. I'd been looking forward to doing this one for a very long time, and I'm glad that we found the right time to do it. Also, the Banff Mountain Film Festival is coming back to Knoxville and the Bijou Theater on March 25th. Get off the beaten path and explore the edge of believable with some of the best outdoor films of the year. Banff brings these captivating and moving stories to the big screen at the Bijou Theater in Knoxville again on March 25th. So stand on the highest peaks and ski the steepest slopes and be a part of the adventures in this year's Banff Mountain Film Festival World Tour. For ticket information, visit knoxbijou.org. That's KNOXBIJOU.org. Get your tickets. All right. It's podcast time. You want to do it?
Sure. It sounds good. I like this setup. It's kind of crazy.
I know. It sounds a lot better than it looks.
No, it feels much more. You feel more connected, and it's like a more intimate setting than if there was no amplification. So I think the headphones are a good touch.
I think so too. I think they work.
The audio sounds incredible. I mean,
yeah, these are the mics, man. This is what the Thriller vocals were recorded with. It's just the SM7B.
Wow.
Sam, that producer that produces the show, he put me onto these, and he says that these are just workhorse mics that everybody uses when they want a voice to sound good.
Right.
Yeah. Who's your friend that was on the Joe Rogan Experience?
Bart Elmore. He's a historian too. He wrote a book about Monsanto.
Oh, yeah. That's fun.
Yeah.
And Joe Rogan read it.
Well, maybe.
He listened to it probably.
Yeah. It was a 3-hour recording. It was insane.
All those are. I don't know how you sit in a chair for 3 hours.
I helped my friend Bart get ready for it.
You did?
We did this thing called a murder board where like people just ask the weirdest out of context questions and see how he responds to them. So
really,
yeah, he needed a lot of preparation. He never done anything like that, you know.
Well, I think you're going to have a podcast tour to do once your book drops and once you're making the rounds.
Well, you always remember your first.
Yeah. Speaking of your first, I think before I started the podcast, which was almost 4 years ago, you were one of the people that I had regular conversations with who I started thinking, you know, I know so many people that know so much cool stuff and so many people that do so many cool things. And like, always say that like interesting stories aren't proprietary to famous people. Like you don't have to be famous to be interesting on a podcast. and you were one of the people that I knew that every time I talked to, I was absolutely fascinated by your knowledge and of history and other things. But the one story that you told me, it was a chapter from your first book, agrarian crossings about the TVA and how, you know, something that's very, you know, obviously huge for this area and had a huge impact on East Tennessee, the whole state, parts of Alabama, Georgia, all over the place, about how the TVA model was co-opted by other countries because it was so successful. What was that? It was just a chapter in agrarian crossings, right?
Yeah.
But it was a fascinating story and fascinating how, you know, this program that I guess was part of the New Deal ultimately, you know, kind of got footing in Tennessee and then became impactful on the whole world. What happened?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great story. That's for sure. And, you know, I think when we usually think about East Tennessee transforming the world, we think about Dolly Parton, but it turns out that there's actually other East Tennessee institutions that have been exported around the world to great acclaim and impact. And the TVA is definitely one of them, mainly because the U.S. is implementing the TVA at a really pivotal moment, and especially right after World War II, much of the world at the time is looking for models for how to deal with poverty and underdevelopment, especially because so many nations were coming out as independent nations, right? Had been under the system of colonialism, right? So much of Africa, much of Asia, parts of Latin America, at least informally, were emerging as independent nations, and they're like, okay, what's our model for lifting up our citizens and raising the gross domestic product and this sort of stuff? And there, many are looking to the U.S. Some are looking to the Soviet Union. But a lot of people are looking to the U.S. because the U.S. wins World War II. They're huge, triumphant, you know, industrial superpower. And the model that the U.S. is sort of handing out as the best way to approach questions of poverty within underdeveloped regions is the TVA, right? It's like, hey, look, we dealt with questions of you know, poverty and lack of industry and underproducting productive farms, and we tackled it in the Tennessee Valley. I mean, they didn't really tackle it. They kind of made a dent in it. They didn't. It was not a silver bullet solution by any means. But because of the TVA as a sort of model, as an image of what can go right in economic development, all these countries in the world become super interested in it. They begin sending ambassadors to go tour Norris Dam and to tour Fort Loudoun Dam. And all these things that we think of as very East Tennessee brought, I mean, people who were super world famous, like David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, comes to hang out in Knoxville and go to, you know, Norris Dam, I think. There's a great photo of him standing in front of that concrete behemoth of that dam.
It's gigantic.
It's massive. Yeah. And if you photograph it the right way, it looks especially massive next to a human being.
Yeah.
But yeah, Jean-Paul Sartre comes here, the French writer and philosopher. Jawaharlal Nehru, the first prime minister of India, another, you know, post-colonial nation that's emerging from British colonialism, and its leaders are kind of looking for models of pathways of development. They look to East Tennessee, and it's super interesting what a cosmopolitan place this was in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. And I don't know if I told you this story, Ben, before, but it led to some difficult scenarios, too. I mean, it was not all a good thing that so many people were coming to East Tennessee, because we have to remember that in this moment, Tennessee is a segregated, right, Jim Crow state. Knoxville is exactly the same. And you have all these visitors from around the world, many who are people of color, who are coming here and they want to see the, you know, the dams. They want to see the turbines. But they're also going to see signs that say for colored, for white. You know,
right,
the spectacle, the sort of the visual markers of Jim Crow. And that's bad PR for the U.S. I mean, they don't want African leaders going back to Africa and saying, wow, the United States is not the country we want to be allies with. They're a bunch of jerks.
We're not welcome there.
Yeah, exactly. So the TVA was really careful to try to negotiate some of this. You know, and the TVA is not a southern agency. It's a federal agency that's, you know, I mean, it's headquartered in Knoxville, but it's still a federal bureau. So Washington does play a significant role in this too. And these federal bureaucrats were really careful to try to give a very manicured version of Knoxville for these visitors, you know, from Africa, from South Asia and whatnot, in the 1950s and 60s. And the funny thing that what they do, because they, if they were to use a regular hotel downtown, they would have to lodge people of different races separately. But instead, they rented a floor. They rent a whole floor of what was then the Farragut Hotel. Mm-hmm. Now I think it's the Hyatt Regency.
Yeah, the Hyatt.
They
place.
Rented the entire fourth floor of that hotel, and they called it the TVA International Visitors Center. And it was basically just a bubble away from Jim Crow. If you went up to the fifth floor or went down to the third floor, all the regular rules of racial segregation would have been in effect. But on that magical fourth floor, people could eat together of various skin tones. They could share rooms. It was like they were in Wisconsin or something, but they were actually in a Jim Crow segregated city. So that for several years, the TVA kept this, you know, facade up to try to show the world the dams and not the reality of racial segregation.
Yeah, I imagine it's like visiting North Korea now. You know, they you get to see the picture they want you to see.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, fancy buildings, people being prosperous. And
what's really interesting is I actually interviewed a Mexican diplomat who came to Knoxville during that time period.
Okay,
I think who stayed in the International Visitor Center, and he was an old guy when I spoke to him, and I asked him, you know, Mr. Cardenas. Did you notice the Jim Crow thing? Like, did you notice the racial segregation? He's like, of course. do you think I was an idiot? They couldn't hide that from us. I mean, it was very, very apparent, but perhaps hidden, you know, in the place where they wound down for the day.
Sure. Well, why was the TVA such a successful model of prosperity and catalyst for you know, bootstrapping impoverished communities up that other countries started to take notice? What was so special about it?
Right. You know, I don't think it was the practical impact, like the dollars generated, the sort of economic impact made. Because let's be honest, Eastern Tennessee remained a highly impoverished region, and not just Eastern Tennessee, but the entire Tennessee Valley remained a pretty poor place for many decades while the TVA was in you know, going on.
Sure.
So it does not overnight remove problems that had been in making for many generations, but it provided really great images. Like, the pictures matter. You know, we talked
really?
About the images. Like, the image of someone standing next to this massive concrete dam is a really powerful symbol of, like, how modern engineering can reshape the world. So I think it's like, it was a game of images and numbers. Like, look how many kilowatts we generated. And then look at this image, you know, of a peasant standing next to a dam. And for third world leaders in the 1950s and 60s, that proved to be a really seductive appeal.
Yeah, right? Like, that sounds like a lot of kilowatts or something. You know,
yeah.
They may not even know.
So they share some stories, they don't share all. They don't share the stories about, well, there were about 100,000 people displaced by these dams.
Right.
They don't talk about the very fierce critique and resistance that came from many local communities when it came to the TVA. They wanted to show the sunny images of, like, the U.S., you know, kind of finding a middle ground between communism on one side and sort of, you know, complete no holds barred capitalism on the other. Like, here we have a government project, but it's not a big government project because, look, it's locally administered here in Tennessee. Like, it's not some distant bureaucrat in Washington telling these farmers and residents what to do. It's like government programs that are people facing, that are more user friendly. And I think the TVA was able to serve as an image in promoting this kind of vision of the U.S. as, yes, you know, we're a capitalist democracy, but we don't do things the way the Soviets do. We don't do things with an iron fist or with a heavy hand. This is more, user-friendly in that regard. Even though, of course, there was plenty of heavy-handedness involved
sure.
in how the TVA operated.
So it was good marketing, is what you're saying.
Yeah, good marketing goes a long way. But, I mean, in international relations and diplomacy, all that stuff matters.
And I'm sure that Washington and you know, the Roosevelt administration and those that came after were proud to be able to point to something that seemingly brought, you know, our country out of, you know, the worst economic situation that we've been in since.
Absolutely. But here's the great irony. At the very moment that the U.S. starts exporting the TVA model, it absolutely puts the brakes on replicating the TVA within the U.S. Because there were all sorts of plans to take this Tennessee Valley Southeastern project and do it on other rivers, like the Columbia River in the Pacific Northwest, multiple river systems that we were going to take the TVA formula and do it. But that does not come to pass. Basically, the TVA gets marked for export only after World War II and goes to, you know, India and Pakistan and Colombia, but does not go to the Pacific Northwest, in part because of the changing political tides, right? I mean, this project is pioneered in the 1930s when there's much more public interest in big government programs because of the Depression and everything. Right. By the time we get Harry Truman and certainly Eisenhower in the 50s, there is a turn away from that. And there's a sense that, no, you know, we need to focus on small government. We need to cut back the size of these programs. Mm. The New Deal didn't have the political purchase that it did in the 1935 or something like that. So the U.S. kind of, you know, even while it's aggressively transplanting this thing around the world, they're quietly refusing to carry the model further within the United States.
So that's why, is that why we only see it, only see this model here in the Southeast?
There's no Valley authorities like it in other, you know, there's no Columbia Valley authority. There's dams, but there's no like massive scale, multi-pronged development projects in other parts of the nation that resemble the sort of nature of the TVA.
You can take a barge from right here outside my house and end up in the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah, that is pretty amazing.
It is. I mean, to make all that navigable. But like you said, I mean, those were creeks and rivers that they dammed up.
Really unpredictable rivers that would sometimes run dry or sometimes overflow at, you know, crazy amounts.
And they dam them up, make reservoirs out of them. But to your point, displace quite a few Americans, Tennesseans in this case.
Right.
But around these, like around Norris Dam, for instance, you'll see the town of Norris. Mm-hmm. I assume they had to bring in hundreds of people, and if not more, and also probably employ some locals as well. Did it start to spring up these towns and developments around here, around the dams? And is that what was so intriguing to these other countries that were looking to implement the model?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it certainly has an economic benefit in recruiting workers to build these dams because they're a huge human undertakings, right? They're not small. The town of Norris is really fascinating because it was a totally planned city, and it was planned by a guy who was pretty much a socialist, which is really interesting.
Nice.
His name is Arthur Morgan, which is kind of funny because we're going to talk about another Arthur Morgan later on, the video game Arthur Morgan. But the original American history Arthur Morgan was the first chairman of the TVA. And he was this kind of socialist utopian. He really, he loved this 19th century author named Edward Bellamy. And Edward Bellamy like wrote this hugely popular sci-fi book in like 1884, which predicted what Boston would look like in the year 2000. Uh-huh. It's this totally wacky Gilded Age sci-fi novel. And he basically predicts that America would be a socialist nation where everything would be run by the government and everyone would be happy. And he makes all these crazy predictions for the future about like what life is like in 2000.
Yeah.
Some are totally spot on and some are absolutely terrible predictions. But he was, you know, far to the left, Bellamy, to be sure. And Arthur Morgan is reading him in the 1920s and 30s. And he's like, we need to take his vision of Boston in the year 2000 and transplant it in this invented city of Norris, Tennessee. So you can still see some, I mean, now it just, if you drive through it, it feels a lot like a regular American suburb, but you can see the sort of, you can still see some artifacts of this planned city that he put in place in the 1930s. There's a sort of village green. There's a grid of streets that was meant to kind of serve social purposes. Mm-hmm. There were communal spaces. It's not like, it's this strange relic of like American leftism that's been left, you know, that's been kind of forgotten on the American landscape, which is quite interesting.
It, you know, it, there's something charming about these planned communities that aren't brand new, you know, because you see they're definitely in vogue again. And you see them, you know, North Shore Town Center is a great example. You have the Publix and a Target and you know, 5,000 square foot townhomes, you know, lining the whole place, and they're gridded out, and to actually see one that you know kind of exists as its own little hamlet, there's a certain
especially
amount of
one that had
charm and idealism to it,
one that was built with like a social agenda. Like it was meant to transform how people thought. And I can't say that's true of, you know, West Knoxville Shopping Center. It's
sure.
Like they're really meant to have a different purpose,
yeah.
To make money. But for Morgan, this was like, we were going to transform the worker and the resident into something new, a new American citizen.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
So what countries did the TVA model get exported to?
Yeah. So, yeah, it's a mix of export and import. I mean, there's interest among many leaders, but then there's great interest in Washington of like pushing this thing out as
right.
as an alternative to Soviet socialism, especially.
Yeah.
So the case that I studied most closely was Mexico. So our southern neighbor had a great interest in TVA and had multiple river valley projects in central and southern Mexico that were explicitly mirrored on the TVA. But then the other famous ones are Colombia. There's India, Pakistan, Afghanistan. In fact, some of the fighting in the U.S. war in Afghanistan took place in the sort of in the shadow of dams built in the image of TVA.
Wow.
I think it's the Damodar. No, Damodar is in Damodar Valley Project is in India. The Helmand Valley Authority was the name of the Afghan TVA of sorts. And I think it's largely abandoned by the time the war breaks out in the early 21st century. But all these American soldiers fighting down there, I wonder, you know, if they were Tennessean soldiers, they probably didn't know the connection, right?
Right.
But they're not in a totally foreign land. They're in right. a land that was shaped by very local projects, to be sure.
Yeah. Well, another thing that's always fascinated me about you is like that is one chapter in Agrarian Crossing, which had how many, 15 or more chapters did it?
Only six chapters.
Yeah. Okay. I thought it had more than that, but it, you know, that's just one topic that you have such like, you know, an inch wide and a mile deep knowledge on, you know, like this
well,
little
these
sliver
are just
of
good stories, right? I like telling good stories because it captivates my students too. You know, so if I can tell something wacky that's going to capture their attention, they're more likely to perk up in their seats.
Well, it perked me right up when we started talking about it. But where did your fascination from world history come from? How did it start?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think my interest in history is definitely wrapped up with my own life story in that there's a great irony in my career in that I study American history. But I am not an American by birth,
right?
So I was born in Sweden and grew up there. And when I was turned 8, my family moved us over, really against my will. I did not want to go. I had like 3 girlfriends in Sweden, and I did not want to say goodbye to any of them.
was that allowed in Sweden? You could have 3 girlfriends, no problem?
You know, I didn't inform the authorities.
Or the other two.
Exactly, right. We were an open, very open society.
Yeah, even at 8 years old.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, we moved over to the US, and I think I got really interested in American history as soon as I got here. And I remember very well, like I had this set of trading cards in 3rd grade, and it wasn't, you know, Marvel or Spider-Man or it was American presidents. It was like, I don't know, all 43 presidents, whatever it was at the time. And I just wore those cards out. I mean, I memorized like, where are those 19th century presidents went to law school and, you know, what
really?
Party they were in. I could tell you about the Whig Party at age 8 in the United States, which is so weird. I've forgotten most of that stuff by now at this point, I will confess.
So was this like a ploy by your parents to get you immersed and acclimated to the culture?
I think it came from me.
Really?
I don't think it was forced upon me. I don't know. American history just seemed so otherworldly. Coming from Sweden, it seemed so exotic in many ways, so
yeah.
distant, especially big conflagrations like the Civil War.
Yeah.
You know, in Sweden, we don't have anything quite like that. Yeah.
Guns.
Right. Well, yeah, American history was just really violent and
yeah.
dramatic. And I'm sure Swedish history is too, but it doesn't quite compare. I mean, we have Vikings, but that's a lot further back.
Right.
Recent history in the U.S. just seemed much more out there. So I was really fascinated in studying it. And throughout middle school and high school, I always did best in my history classes.
Really?
Yeah. So when I got to college, you know, it was kind of a no-brainer that, oh, sure, I'll major in history. Why not?
Do you remember having a feeling when you moved over here? And I'm sure you had a cursory understanding of the country that you came from and how old it was and all this. Did you have a feeling that we were that the United States was like this brand new-ish country, or did you not have kind of the context of the scale involved.
I mean, I grew up, the church that we went to, we went very infrequently, but we went once a year for Christmas. The church was 950 years old.
Right.
So,
and so you come to a country that's 250 years old or something at the time?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that maybe that was part of the exotic appeal of U.S. history, is that it was fairly abbreviated, like fairly short.
Yeah.
As a nation, at least, obviously. People have been living here for thousands and thousands of years. But the idea of American, you know, that the 19th century was like the early part of American history. In Sweden, that's not the case.
Yeah, it was like yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah.
So why did your family move here? And was it difficult to immigrate to the United States as a Swede?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I wasn't handling the immigration papers being 8 years old, and I'm glad I did not have to deal with that.
I didn't know if you heard any stories or anything.
Yeah. Well, so it was for economic opportunities, the kind of classic immigrant story.
Yeah.
It's classic in many ways. It's classic that, you know, economic opportunities drew us. And it's classic, too, in the sense that we went with the intention of staying for a year and then returning to Sweden.
Mm.
And we would say it every single year, you know, that, oh, well, we're going to go home really, really soon. And then, you know, now I've been here for 30 plus years.
Did you speak any English when you came?
Not really.
Yeah.
I mean, my parents have been trying to train me up a little bit
during
that summer, at least, before we moved. But I was really coming pretty blind. I just really didn't have all that much preparation. But, you know, when you're that age, you suck things up just so quickly. You're like a real sponge. And, you know, I remember they gave me the option of taking ESL classes.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, no, I think I'll pass.
Really?
My brother took ESL classes. He was a little younger than me. But I chose not to. And I remember very well, within 3 months of us moving here, my brother was six at the time. Within 3 months of us moving here, we were speaking English to each other at home.
Really?
We're no longer communicating in Swedish with one another.
That's
which
fascinating.
Which is pretty crazy.
I mean, that's why I want my kids to learn Spanish right now.
They need to.
Because I'm still working on, you know, I have... you know, 2 years of high school Spanish, and I'm shocked at how much I retained. But like, you know, going to Latin America or Mexico once a year makes me realize what a just whiff I pulled by not learning Spanish as a kid. And I'm trying to relearn it now, and it's hard.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, your brain just can gather languages much quicker. And you know what's great is that once you have a second language, especially when you're a kid, learning the third is much easier, right? So like, I learned Spanish as my third language. First in middle school and high school, but then I got very serious about it in college and or really in grad school when I was doing research on Mexico. And I was shocked at how much better I was than my, you know, monolingual English friends who were trying to learn Spanish, because they just wrestled with some of the, you know, brain work. And for me, it was like second nature because I'd always grown up speaking Swedish and English. So
did you interview the Mexican diplomat in English or Spanish when you interviewed him?
It was a little bit of Spanglish. We were kind of going back and forth.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
So your parents moved you over here when you're eight. You have, where were you guys living?
In Brookline, Massachusetts. And since I have presidential trivia for you, the home of John F. Kennedy,
okay.
The birthplace of JFK, Michael Dukakis, a failed presidential candidate from the 80s, also
yep.
a Brooklinian. It's basically a streetcar suburb of Boston. I mean, it's surrounded by Boston on all sides. So I really grew up in Boston, but in a kind of cozy, green, you know, kind of boulevard version of Boston that was leafy and pleasant.
Yeah. Well, what shocked me before we sat down and started talking here was it sounds like your middle and high school years were a lot like mine, and you were focused on things other than academics and that, you know, you becoming an academic was probably not on your mind when you were in high school.
No, I loved history, but I really loved my primary hobby a lot more, which was playing video games.
Well,
particularly PC games. Yeah, it was a problem.
Were you a computer guy? What are we playing?
Not a computer guy, a computer nerd.
Really?
Which was like a real thing in the 90s. Nowadays, I think that phrase computer nerd has fallen from favor because everyone's looking at screens all day.
Yeah.
But like back in the 90s, that was not a thing you wanted pinned to your reputation, but I didn't care. You know, there was just no denying it.
All
I cared about was, you know, silly games. Yeah.
So MS-DOS, like sticking the discs in and playing Frogger.
I think it was started a little more sophisticated than that, you know. But yeah, hopped onto Windows 3.1 eventually. But yeah, a lot of discs, a lot of 5 1/4 and 3.5 inch discs in my background.
But not Nintendo stuff. You weren't playing Super Mario Brothers or anything like that. You were doing the PC thing.
Yeah, you know, I think we were able to fool my parents in saying that if we get a computer, you know, we can learn C++.
Oh yeah,
it had so much more potential of like being, we can type our papers on there, we can surf the web using Netscape Navigator.
Yeah.
So I think it had a little bit more cachet with my parents, you know. Mm-hmm. Like the Super Nintendo was just, or any of those systems, were just purely for entertainment. Though of course I played much more games on the computer than I ever would on a Super Nintendo. I mean, it was so it was a PC, it was the system. And you know, the 90s was kind of a golden era of PC gaming. A lot of the kind of big franchises that are still popular today, like Warcraft, StarCraft, Diablo, Half-Life, Doom, Quake.
Yeah.
Those are all coming out when I was in high school, and that's like all that I thought about.
Did you ever play Command & Conquer Red Alert?
Yeah, totally.
That game taught me about economics, it taught me about war, it taught me how to protect yourself, all kinds of stuff.
Video games can teach you stuff, man. There's no denying that.
I mean, not always well,
but they can at least give you a passion and an interest for learning something later on.
So you went to UMass, right? Mm-hmm. Straight from there?
Yeah.
Or straight from high school?
Yeah, which, somehow they let me in with my 2.7 GPA from playing too much Quake at home.
and at what point did you decide that you wanted to not just do undergrad, but do more than that?
Yeah, I mean, it was in my first semester, basically, that I realized that a history major was for me. That was not undertaken with any kind of career path in mind. It was just like, I love doing this. I'm doing well in these classes. Let's continue. And I think it was toward the end of undergrad that I was just, I really love being in school. I love doing all the, you know, school related stuff. And I was envisioning a future without that, and it made me sad.
Yeah.
So having little, few marketable skills otherwise, I was like, oh, let's apply to graduate school and go seek a PhD in history.
That's how my wife is. I mean, I'm, you know, just a fantastic student, really good at it, was in school forever. I joke around with her. I'm like, when are you going to go back to school? You've been in school. We've been together for, you know, almost 20 years. You're in school for more than half of it. Like, you know, it's your thing. Some people are good at it. I couldn't have gotten out fast enough.
Yeah.
You know, it just wasn't for me. I always say, and I did end up going back to film school, but I always say that I learned more. I learned 5% of what I knew in film school. And then I learned the rest of the 95% that I knew a year later after I started working. It was always like a vocational type deal. I think it's just different kinds of people. But did you find that you had like an uncanny ability to contextualize history and retain information? Or what was it about history that made you so drawn to it, other than just an innate interest for it? Yeah. What made you good at it, I guess?
I think what set me apart was that I was an outsider to American history.
Mm.
Right? This, again, goes back to the life story. And I think all scholars are shaped by their own backgrounds and kind of what passions they have. And for me, being a non-American interested in American history made me ask questions a little bit differently. I got very interested in Southern history because I went to grad school at the University of Georgia, and they had a big Southern history program. But the question I always wanted to ask was not, why is the South not like the North, which is like the classic refrain of Southern history for so long. Instead, I wanted to know, why is the South actually kind of like these other places around the world? Who cares about the North, right? Mm-hmm. Like, why is it that the U.S. South and, let's say, Mexico share some interesting patterns when it comes to politics and farming systems and inequalities in certain ways? So I was kind of transcending those usual binaries that a lot of American historians would ask.
You were asking different questions than everyone else.
Yeah, that was part of it. Part of it, too, is that I just love to write. And I really first became a writer writing sci-fi fantasy stories in middle school and preparing Dungeons and Dragons campaigns. That was like my first real writing experience. And I loved doing that. So when I got to grad school, I got to write, you know, not about wizards and dungeons. Well, real for the most part.
The Magna Carta.
Yeah. I got to write about other stuff. But I still had that kind of passion for putting words on the page. And I think as the years have gone by, I think of myself more as a writer, actually, not just a historian, but as someone who writes books and enjoys it. And especially this most recent book that I just finished. Really had a blast writing it, so eager to write more in that vein.
I think I first heard about, I don't know if I heard about the book first or if there was like a USA Today article or something that was about your class that you were teaching at the university that was about a video game or uses video game, a certain video game as a substrate to tell history from.
Yeah, it got a lot of publicity back in 2021. Yeah. When I first tried this experiment.
Had you written the book yet?
No, I didn't even know I was going to.
Really?
I was just trying to find a way to rationalize my new pandemic hobby of playing video games once again.
Yeah. So after Georgia, you came to Tennessee as faculty or as a student? Or I guess it's kind of both there for a second, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I've got my PhD in 2013, and my very first job was an assistant professor at UT. So I came as a faculty member, and the first 6 or 7 years or so, you're like probationary status, essentially, right. That, you know, you got to publish or perish. That's the nature of the beast. Since this is UT is a research oriented university where production of new knowledge is really my job just as much or more than teaching. And I wrote my first book that came out in 2017, totally academic book. You're very kind for having purchased and read some part of it because it's a little dry. I'm not going to lie. I mean, I'm proud of it, but it's not the book I wanted to write 4 times again, you know?
Yeah, I bet it made the second one better.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I figured out what not to do as well.
And when was the first one written again?
2017 is when it came out. And it was really my dissertation revised and made a little bit more accessible. So it was a project. When it came out in 2017, I'd been working on it for 8 years. So this is a long haul project. But it let me go to Mexico and, you know, follow the TVA's trail around the world, among other things.
Well, how does the process work? I mean, I know so many people who have a manuscript, you know, or write a book, but you actually got one, you know, published and sold, can be purchased on Amazon right now.
It's true. Well, I have two very different experiences with publishing because my first book was with Princeton University Press, you know, very solid academic press.
Sounds prestigious.
Yeah. And, you know, that stuff does matter in the academic circuit. I think much less of it now than I used to think of it. But, you know, I wanted a big fancy name, academic press, when I was publishing my first book because it helped me get tenure and, you know, get you noticed and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, the fanciness of the press doesn't mean that there's any more readers, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's still very small audience.
Still a meritocracy when it comes down to your book selling.
Yeah, well, most academic books just sell very minimally. And when I say minimally, I'm talking like, you know, outside of library sales, maybe, you know, 100 copies. That's like probably your average for an academic book. It's not a
really
lot. Very small.
Do they ever get picked up as required text or anything for or required reading for
some?
Yeah. Is that what you're hoping for? Or
I think you're hoping for specialists in your field to read it and kind of rethink how they teach certain things or how they, you know, maybe adoption in graduate classes. But you also, the dream is to win awards for these books.
Gotcha. Right?
You send your book out for lots of awards, and I was very fortunate that my book actually won 5 awards, which is, well, it's pretty unusual, I gotta say.
But. Right. So even though, you know, you might not be on a New York bestsellers list, it's almost an even bigger accomplishment to be used and referenced by your peers, it sounds like.
Yeah, I know. But I think the New York Times bestseller list is actually more important.
Is it? You'd rather be universally read by, you know, 10% of the country's population than respected by
35 people.
Yeah, 35 peers of yours across the country. Okay.
I mean, I wouldn't have said that in 2017 when my book came out because it had no chance of being on the New York Times bestseller list. But since then, I've done a lot. I've matured a lot and thought a lot about, you know, what I'm doing and what history's role in the general public is. Because I think as long as academics solely write these kind of narrow monographs is what we call them, monographs, like a you know, a book on one subject.
Right.
As long as we only produce that, I think we remain pretty inaccessible to the public. And we remain kind of siloed off in that world, especially if we write in a style that's kind of, you know, impenetrable to your average reader. And I think that more of us, not all of us, but more of us historians should try to take this wealth and abundance of knowledge from the academy and make it meaningful and accessible to regular people. And I think doing that sometimes involves, you know, hanging this material on some pop culture hooks, you know, to meet people where they're at, like your average reader, and to try to make this stuff accessible and fun and interesting to them.
Right. And so once you had tenure once you were tenured after 2017 and had written your book, did you then feel like you were emboldened to do exactly what you just said, which is more meet your students where they're at, not necessarily have to write an academics book, but rather something that you felt you could take some chances with, but also do something a little bit different, think about things in a different way. And I guess, did you just become a little more bold?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think tenure as an institution has that ability to let people follow their passions without fear of immediate judgment, at least by their peers. So I'm very thankful that that institution exists and allows people to kind of, you know, do something a little wacky.
Yeah.
So it was right after I finished that, my first book, that I knew that I didn't want to write exactly that kind of book again.
Okay.
So I went out and I secured a literary agent, which is a really important part of writing commercial, what I'll call trade press books, trade press book being the kind of opposite from university press academic books. Mm. You know, like the Simon and Schuster, Penguin, you know, those are all trade presses. Yeah. The
ones that people have in their house.
Exactly. And they're basically all located in New York City. There's like 50 blocks in Manhattan that is like the home to the publishing industry.
Yeah.
And to crack into that world is very difficult. There's a lot of aspiring authors. Those folks with manuscripts know, right, that it's very hard to get in. And a literary agent is not essential, but it's very helpful. So I inherited essentially an agent from one of my colleagues in the history department, and I began working on a book that I thought would had the potential of reaching a wider audience, which was it stemmed from my original work that's kind of about the South and the world, but it was about country music. It was about I wanted to write a global history of American country music and trace, like, how did Dolly Parton, Kenny Rogers, and Jim Reeves, and people like that, how do they get to be famous in Nigeria, in the Philippines, and Japan? What kinds of institutions carried these musicians, which so many Americans regard as, like, you know, domestic and nothing but, like, could never be popular outside the U.S. But in reality, they're quite popular, an American export comparable in many ways to rock and roll or jazz or blues or something like that. So for several years, I was working on this book project about country music and its travels, but then the pandemic got in the way, right? March 2020, I was just about to book flights to go to Nigeria and to the Philippines to trace some of these musicians and records around the world, but I got stopped dead in my tracks by COVID, and things took unpredictable directions ever after that.
Right. Did this book ever become anything other than
not yet? Just I have book? Tons of research sitting on my computer that I'm eager to share with the world. I mean, I've got some great stories in another, you know, potential future podcast down the road. I'll tell you all about, because I've got some great tales from that one. But no, as of now, I haven't published anything on it. But I do plan on doing it, whether it'll be a book or an article, kind of up in the air right now.
Yeah. So. The press that I ended up seeing was, and I guess I have another question about getting a literary agent at a trade press and then wanting, you know, well, I mean, I assume it's dollars and cents for them. They want you to sell books, right? So, I mean, the log line of your newest book is like, you tell anybody just one sentence about it, and it is fascinating to hear. So was this something that you came up with on your own to teach this class, or was this something that people were like, no, we gotta have something that's packageable and sellable and, you know, word of mouth gonna travel fast? Like, how did this
you talking about the country music project?
No, I'm talking about the Red Dead
Yeah, but, right on. So it was a class first and foremost, right? So pandemic interrupts my country music research. Instead, I return to the drawing board, or should I say the gaming board?
Yeah.
Because I buy a computer. I buy a new gaming PC. You know, I haven't played video games in like 20 years at this point. I've got tenure. I feel like maybe it'll be okay. Maybe it won't ruin my life this time.
Yeah.
You know, and my worry was that this might impact my professional career.
You'll get addicted to playing video games and yeah. Won't be doing the things you really need to be doing.
Yeah, for sure. Well, yeah. I was worried, you know, this might have a professional impact. Never could I have expected that it would have a positive professional impact. I mean, that was absolutely unfathomable in 2020 when I picked up video games again. But it was very early in the pandemic that I played a video game that would change the course of my professional and, in part, personal life, which is I sat down and played Red Dead Redemption 2, which was a fairly new game in 2020 when I picked it up. And it has since become the 7th best-selling video game of all time.
Wow.
It has sold now more than 60 million copies.
Wow.
And then it's probably been played by, I don't know, 300, 400 million people total.
It's amazing.
If you count all the people who pirated it and watched it on YouTube
sure.
and watched it over a friend's shoulder.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. So it is this juggernaut of pop culture.
Right.
I can't stop raffling off like statistics about this game because they're so shocking. Like when that game released in 2018, it earned more money in its opening weekend sales than any other entertainment product ever made previously. Like
really?
In its opening weekend.
Yeah.
No movie, no Harry Potter book. Nothing had earned as much money in one weekend as Red Dead 2 did in 2018, which is pretty stupendous. Yeah. But I play this game not for fun necessarily. I play it as a historian, you know, as a historian
really?
Of this period.
I really?
Mean, all right, I picked it up for fun. But I can't turn the historian in me off, right?
Right.
It's just permanently on. There's no switch that easily works.
So did you buy it, start playing this game, and then you just can't untether yourself from this like historical narrative that you are already kind of very familiar with and very fascinated with?
Yeah, I think what really fired me up as I was playing the game was like how often the game would connect to some of the big questions we talk about in history classes. You know, questions about corporate capitalism, which is really coming into shape in the late 19th century at the moment that the game is set. Questions of race in the South, of wars between the U.S. military and Native people in the West, like all these things that I teach about regularly, suddenly they're on the screen and like sometimes they're stupid
yeah.
in how they're portrayed. But sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're like, wow, this is kind of an interesting perspective it gives on things. So it was like really soon. I mean, like maybe 20 hours into the game, which is actually not that much. The game takes like 80 hours to finish. It's
yeah.
massively long. But about 20, 30 hours into the game, I realize, wait a minute, why don't I try teaching a course based on this class that would draw students in who love the game, but then use the fictional content of the series and actually teach some real history and get students fired up about it, you know, in the meantime. Because it just seemed obvious to me. But then I was shocked to learn that no historian had ever tried this before. I would be the first person doing this.
With that game or with any video game?
With that game.
Okay.
There have been other classes on video games and history, to be sure, but no American historian had tried to take this. I mean, it's really this generation's Oregon Trail.
Right.
In terms of its impact.
I was
and
about
influence.
To mention the Oregon Trail.
Yeah.
Well,
except Oregon Trail is something your teacher told you to play.
Right.
You read that too. Your teacher stays away from because it's violent and it's nasty.
Yeah.
And it's something that's cool, according to, you know, like the 17-year-old perspective, because
right.
this is like not what your teacher is pushing down your throat.
So for those people who haven't interacted with the game at all, what's the premise of it?
Yeah. So it's set in 1899. And most people who might have seen an advertisement for it or anything might assume that it's a Western, like a cowboy game of mm-hmm. sorts. And they really lean into that in the marketing. But it's actually way more than that. And only about half of the game takes place in the West. Large chunks take place in southern Appalachia, in the deep South, in the kind of cotton country. So all the names of people and places are fictionalized. So it has like states in the game, but they don't exist, right? There's a state called Lemoyne, which is something like a combination of Mississippi and Louisiana.
Okay.
So it fictionalizes the names. But then, yeah, it takes place in the Caribbean as well, like on this unnamed sugar island. And there's it's way more than just that kind of Western. But it's set in 1899. You follow this outlaw gang that is escaping from authority, and they trek all across the United States and just see a lot of American society while obviously shooting people along the way. Yeah. I mean, it's a very violent game. It's not my favorite part of the game, I'll be honest, but you get used to it when you play it enough, to be sure.
What is the player trying to do? What are you trying to do in this game? Okay, gotcha.
Basically, there's the Oregon Trail. Yeah, it has that survival mechanism to it. You want to avoid getting, you know, apprehended by the law, by the Pinkertons, by, you know, private detective agencies who are pursuing
bounty
you.
Hunters.
Bounty hunters, there's plenty of those. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, it has a great storyline. It really does. It's well written, well acted. It's really kind of like an interactive HBO show. It's kind of like interactive Deadwood, if you've seen that one, in terms of the vision of the West that it captures, at least.
And I mean, you see Yellowstone now, and it's no wonder they leaned into the American West marketing with this, because it's so romantic to so many people.
Cash cow.
Yeah.
You know, it's an established genre in the way that Southerns is not a genre in the way that Westerns are.
That's right.
It's tied up to, romantic visions of the American character and identity and all this.
So when you took this idea, I assume do you have to clear this with anybody?
Yeah,
you have to clear it with a dean or something like that?
Not
or
the dean.
Some faculty?
I had to clear it with my associate head, who is the person in my department who is responsible for the undergraduate program.
Okay.
And I basically pitched it to him. And he's a little bit older than me and not a video gamer at all. And I was like, you know, can I teach this class that uses the Red Dead Redemption games to get at dilemmas in American history? And my leadership of the department was like, what's that?
Yeah.
And they're like, do you think students will sign up?
I
was like, yeah, see, that's the whole premise.
Right.
They're going to be interested. So they're like, you know, we trust you. You've been teaching somewhat experimental classes previously. This is definitely a step further, to be sure.
Yeah.
But if you think students will sign up, go ahead and try it.
That's cool.
So they gave me the green light, you know, to pursue whatever I wanted to do with it.
Are you a bit younger than them? So do you think they thought that you kind of had a finger on the pulse of what people that are maybe closer to your age than they are to their age would sign up for?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a bit younger than these guys who gave me the permission, but I'm also a lot older than the students too.
Yeah.
So I'm closer in age to them, to my historian colleagues, than the students by this point.
Yeah, I forget.
But because because I have been, I was pretty hooked into the kind of gaming industry and had some personal history there. They thought that, you know, well, I mean, here's the thing. Historians have taught classes about movies and books and TV shows. Like, we use pop culture all the time. I think there was just a reluctance to include video games within that, you know, umbrella or within that tent, because of the negative associations that surround many video games. That they're violent, they're misogynist, they're mindless, they're killing brain cells actively left and right. And of course, there are many stupid, dumb, hateful, yucky video games. But then there's some really interesting ones too.
Right.
And I thought, even though Red Dead 2 is violent, to be sure, I found it interesting. And I found it a useful tool for potentially teaching some of the biggest and trickiest dilemmas in American history.
Yeah, a good conduit for the material.
Yeah, exactly. And for me, it was all about getting as many students on board as possible.
Right.
And I wanted to, of course, get history majors, but I really wanted to get non-history majors, people who would never take a history class otherwise.
Yeah.
And, you know, for the last 20, 30 years, we've seen a real decline in history majors as, you know, society has gone all STEM like the only solution to things. And I think the history and the larger humanities remain so important. We have such important stories to tell that, you know, you can't make, like, the STEM people don't have, they don't have any content to talk about if they don't have the humanities as part of it. So this is part of a larger plot to win back some of those majors, right? So I wanted the computer science majors who were like, you know, taking coding as their other classes, but then, maybe I can use my video game love to get some elective credit over in history here.
Yeah.
And it actually worked. There were lots of non-majors who took the class that first semester and who continued taking the class through the years since then.
I remember when I was at UT, Wendell Werner, was that his name? He taught the history of rock and roll. You could not get into that class, no matter how hard you tried. There were so many people that wanted to do it. I don't know if it was because it was just fascinating. You had to talk about Jimi Hendrix and the Doors and, you know, Pink Floyd and all that stuff, or what it was. But Yeah. I can see how that's valuable to a department somewhere.
Oh, yeah. I mean, generating student credit hours, that is how we are evaluated.
Really? Is that the metric?
Yeah. One of many, but it's an important one, to be sure.
Yeah.
And I was interested in you know, if rock and roll draws seats, well, let's try video games.
Sure.
And again, it's going to be a serious class. We're going to talk about all the heavy, you know, we've talked about politics and race and class and gender and all the kinds of things that historians usually talk about. We're just going to do it with the hook of the video games drawing people in. Mm-hmm. And of course, I touch on the game fairly regularly in class. So it's not just a hook to get them in the door. It's
right.
not a scam. Like
right.
the game, the class still is about video games partially.
Right. Well, it's, you know, it's fascinating to me that you can be a gateway drug for history majors, you know.
That is definitely the purpose I want to serve. An ambassador. How about that?
An ambassador.
Drug is important too.
Yeah. So how did, when I read this article, was it USA Today? I mean, it was some, or CBS, I forget where it was. It got picked up by a lot of people like, look what this crazy professor in Tennessee is doing.
Yeah. It got covered the heaviest in the gaming news, like
did
GameSpot it? And yeah, a number of these sites picked it up, but some local media sites picked it up too. I think one of the local, maybe the New Sentinel or one of the TV stations did some publicity on it
okay.
too. But yeah, the Smithsonian magazine wrote about it.
Maybe that's
it made its way into some, you know, unexpected places, to be sure.
Yeah. Do you know if, well, what level class is it?
It's a 300 level kind of up. It's not the highest upper division class, but it's a 300 level course. It usually is capped at about 35 seats, but mm-hmm. every time I've taught it, it's been higher than that. I'm teaching it this semester and it's got 75 students in it. So it's a much larger class than most of my usual classes of that same level.
Okay. And how long have you been teaching it now?
Since 2021. So this okay. current semester is my third time doing it.
So now they won't, now it's like, it's a hot one. They won't, now you can't drop it. I mean, you're going to have to keep teaching it, right?
I know. I mean, I want to keep teaching it, but I know it won't last forever, because when you spin a class around pop culture, you know, pop culture has a timestamp. It doesn't
yeah.
last forever.
It's a shelf life.
Yeah. I mean, I think the shelf life of games made by this developer, Rockstar, they also make Grand Theft Auto.
Mm-hmm.
The shelf life is significantly longer than your average video game.
Okay.
I mean, people, even though this game is now more than 5 years old, they're still selling copies of this game like crazy, and it has
really?
A huge player count on many of the platforms. So it has a longer shelf life, but it's not going to last forever. I mean,
yeah.
there's going to come a time when I'm going to have to abandon this and move to something else.
Right.
Which is fine. I got to stay fresh.
Yeah. I like that. You know, when I think of, when I relate it to that history of rock and roll class, which was a 100 level class when I was
right.
when I was at UT, you know, we grew up, you know, listening to our parents' music. We grew up fascinated by the Doors and all this, you know, this old stuff. It's kind of like vinyl is now, you know, it was cool then to like the old thing. And, you know, it seems like your class, again, you met them where they were. You know, this is a much more digital age. You're you know, Gen Z students that are college age now are, you know, video everything has been in their lives since they were born. So,
they've been playing Minecraft since they were like 8 years old.
Yes. And so it seems like a really, like, you know, a really good calculated move in some ways to start, you know, using video games and things that people are already, you know, people grew up doing to further be able to capitalize on that interest. So it does make a lot of sense. It's like, who knows what the next one's going to be. You're going to be teaching a TikTok history class or something. I mean, that's like 10 years from now. I feel like that's going to be the thing. So you taught the class for how long before you decided to start writing a book about it?
It was really at the end of that first semester.
Yeah, you're right? Like, so, there's some meat left on this bone.
Yeah, for sure. Well, so it's just, whenever you roll out a new class, it is just a boatload of work. I was writing, especially because this is a pretty lecture-oriented class. We had a lot of discussions, but most of the time I'm lecturing and I'm preparing, you know, presentations. They've got YouTube videos from the game, you know, footage. I mean, there was so much labor that went into that class. It was fun, but it was a lot of work. That I thought at the end of it, you know, I have this, you know, semester's worth of material prepared. I know there's an audience for this beyond the University of Tennessee.
Mm.
So, and again, this is like pandemic times. I still can't travel to Nigeria and the Philippines to do my country music research. So I approached my agent and I said, hey, you know, I think Global Cowboy is going to be on hiatus for a little bit. I've got another idea for book number two, or for my second book. And I'm like, what do you know about Red Dead Redemption 2? And my agent, who's a good bit older than me, and she's a woman, and she's like, I've never heard of it. And I'm like, hey, well, let me tell you the story. You know, I tell her about the class. I tell her about the idea behind it. To basically write a book for video gamers, like to write for the folks who love this game. And there's a lot of people who love this game. But to use their passion and enthusiasm about the game and use it as a gateway to exploring some of the real stuff. You know, like, why was America violent in this period? What was driving that violence? Well, it comes back to big socioeconomic dilemmas, which the game touches on but doesn't fully explore. So it's like taking the game but going many steps further. But keeping it fun and playful and, you know, engaging for those readers.
Right. So but accidentally getting educated while you read it.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a very kind of Trojan horse effect, yeah, you know. The Red Dead can sneak into your house this way, and then it starts suddenly teaching you things, which is cool. But yeah, learning can be fun, right? Education and learning new things can be fun. It doesn't have to be dry and forced and painful. But yeah, so I pitch it to my agent, and she's like, this is really cool. Let's write up a proposal. So I worked back and forth with her to write a proposal. And then it's the job of the agent to shop. I mean, it's really the role of the agent to get you a contract, because they're a free agent. They don't work for a press themselves, but they know they have connections with publishers of that New York world.
Yeah, they work for you technically, right?
Exactly. They only get paid when I get paid.
Right.
And the industry standard is 15%.
Yeah.
Right. So my agent takes 15% of anything that I earn on the book, which might seem like a lot in one way. But, you know, having an agent takes you into levels of, you know, potential money that you would never have on your own. So that's 15% of a lot more is better than 0% of nothing.
Yeah. You know? It's the industry standard because it's worth it.
It is absolutely worth it. And my agent was terrific. Deborah Grosvenor. Loved working with her. On this proposal, and she was just such a pro in taking this thing up the chain to shop it around. But yeah, I eventually got a contract with a really great New York publisher. Macmillan is the parent house, and then St. Martin's is the name of the press, and got me lined up with an editor there that I really enjoyed working with. And this is a very different experience from publishing with Princeton University Press, my first book, right? I mean, like, I had no agent that time. There was no money involved whatsoever. And the whole thing was just, you know, it was always scholarly from the beginning with the first book.
Right.
You know, there was always an assumption that this would be a small readership, important, but a smaller readership. And it's been a very different, you know, game with the trade press industry.
Yeah, I mean, it took that experience. I mean, could you imagine going into this one with no prior author?
I needed the reputation, you know, like I needed the reputation of having written an acclaimed academic book with a really top-notch academic publisher. That kind of gave me that gravitas to be able to pitch something else. Because, I mean, there's all kinds of bozos writing about video games on the internet.
Sure.
But most of them are not getting trade publishing deals because they don't have that same, they don't have a platform in that same sort of way. And I did have to earn it by working my way up to it and, you know, doing the grunt work of academic history, which is fun too. I mean, I love doing that, but this could not have been my first book.
Right.
Like if I came to UT, I'm like, oh, it's to write about video games to get tenure. Yeah. Oh, that's a hard sell.
Yeah.
I'd get some raised eyebrows in my, among my colleagues, and rightly so. I mean, I think you have to prove yourself that you can hone the craft and do the craft before you can begin experimenting with
right.
it. I think that only makes sense.
I think when you, cause you and I knew each other when you published your first book, and you were definitely excited about it. No doubt.
Yeah.
But this level of excitement that I've seen from you on this one seems even greater than that, perhaps by an order of magnitude. So what are some big wins that have come along with this book?
Yeah, for sure. Well, so the book comes out in August and still a couple months away, to be sure. So there's a lot of question marks in the air. But in many ways, the biggest breakthrough as I've seen it, I mean, the most important thing was finishing the manuscript and, you know, working my editor to get it in good shape. And I'm really proud of it. I like it a lot. But the real breakthrough that's come recently has to do with the audiobook version.
Which is huge, right?
Yeah, so I mean,
more people are listening to books now than ever.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a huge part of the publishing industry. And I really always felt from the beginning that with a book aimed at gamers, audiobook might be the biggest medium, given that, I mean, I can't speak for all of them, but I think there's a lot of gamers who don't read a lot of print books.
Right.
Mainly because they're playing video games instead, sure. Right? They love digital media. And they're probably hesitant. I mean, there are gamers that have bookshelves with lots of books on them, but there's many who don't. And I want to reach all of them. And I thought that someone listening to the book, I would have a higher chance of reaching a new audience of, mm-hmm. of readers, or at least listeners in that
right.
sense.
And from what I understand, like, especially with biographies and sometimes with other work, the people oftentimes want to hear the author read these books. Like, I always think of Obama's book. Like, everybody wanted to hear him read it. Yeah. And if someone else would have read it. I have a friend who lives in Nashville. He's actually been on the podcast before. His name's Michael Figlio. And he has made a burgeoning business out of recording audiobooks with the authors, because it's apparently a new trend to where, instead of recording, just having a voice actor read your book in a studio in New York, now these publishers want the author to read their books in a lot of cases. So yeah. It sounds like, and fiction may be a completely different story, but it sounds like who voices your book is very important.
Yeah. And I think when the author has a really high public profile, you really want them reading the book.
Yeah.
You know, you want Amy Poehler reading her autobiography
yeah.
or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But I'm not a famous person. Right, I don't have a public profile in that sense. So I knew that I didn't want me to be the reader.
Right.
I mean, as any listener to this podcast knows, I have an annoying nasally voice that no one wants to hear for 8 hours.
I think it sounds great.
Well, thanks, Ben. It's very kind of you. But I've always felt, self-critical.
Everyone hates their own voice.
Yeah,
though.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I knew I didn't want to do it. But so I was thinking, what kind of a narrator, what kind of a reader could I get for this book, Red Dead's History, that would really click and open new doors to reaching folks in the game world who love the game, you know, and might be interested in learning the deeper side of the history. And just recently, my publisher and I lined up who is going to be narrating the audiobook version of that. And I'm so excited to announce that it's the actor who plays Arthur Morgan in Red Dead Redemption 2, which is Roger Clark, who is an absolutely astounding actor who won many awards for his performance in the game. But he's the voice of the game. Like, anyone who's played Red Dead 2 have heard Arthur Morgan speak for hours on end, right? Talking about his horse and his camp and about, I mean, all, you know, his life. It has this very iconic kind of cowboy twang to his voice. And now he's going to be the one reading the book, which I'm just like giddy.
I mean,
about
that sounds like as big of a home run as you could hit.
There's no better narrator in the world for this book,
right,
than Roger Clark.
Not even Sam Elliott. You know, the guy who's in the game has to be the guy to read the book.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
so
fantastic,
I'm really,
man.
Really thrilled about that.
How did that process work? I'm sure you had to reach out to him somehow, or I'm sure your agent did, or the publisher did. The publisher reached out and said, we've got this book. We think it's going to do great.
Yeah, yeah. No, they pitched, I think they sent him a manuscript. They pitched the idea, and he loved it.
That's
I'm
awesome.
Very thankful, too, because Roger has done many other audiobooks previously. He
okay.
has a real kind of rich career in voice acting. I mean, for the game, he's not just voice acting. It's motion capture, too. So there's much more than
he's
just
the
voice.
He's got the little green balls on him and
yep.
he's jumping around the,
exactly.
the studio.
Exactly. So there's more that goes into it. But his voice is just iconic. It's unbelievable. It's so rich. It has so much character and emotion in it. And I'm just so honored that he'll be bringing my words to the larger public. So this is a huge coup. I still can't believe, I'm still pinching myself that this is a reality.
Well, that also to me says that this publisher believes in this book, because I mean, they're taking a chance by engaging him, right?
Yeah.
And
he's a busy guy.
Yeah, I'm sure. And you know, to already, before the book has even been printed to or been published, to already just start to get some momentum has to feel pretty cool.
Yeah. There's a really fun Knoxville twist to the story too. So I mentioned previously, I'm teaching this class this semester in mm-hmm. spring of 2024. And I have arranged a secret surprise visit to my class of two significant individuals. Now remember, my class is like 75 game nerds. Not all of them. I mean, some of them are not total gamers. But, you know, two-thirds of them have played like 100 plus hours of Red Dead Redemption 2. And in March of this year, right before spring break, I've arranged a surprise visit of number one, Roger Clark, Arthur Morgan, that is, and number two, Rob Weathoff, who plays John Marston in the first game. So I'm bringing the actors who play the lead characters in the first Red Dead and the second Red Dead unannounced to my class in March.
That's so cool.
And the students know nothing about it.
How are you going to, I mean, these kids, if they love this game enough to take a 300 level class, and you know,
they're gonna freak out.
Yeah, I can imagine. So have you thought about your about how the entrance is gonna go, or
I've thought about it very closely. And so the whole thing, we'll have a camera crew on site, so they're gonna be capturing all of this student reactions and all this for social media, you know, so we can put this on TikTok and Instagram and all that to promote the book and the class and all that. But I've thought long and hard about the entrance and all this. I'm going to have two big leather chairs sitting on the stage. You know, I'll have told the students we're doing something unusual, but, you know, they don't know how unusual. Wow. And then I'll just ask them, you know, with some kind of introduction, I'll ask each to walk in separately. And then the students are just going to, they're going to flip. I mean, the dream was that this would be one of the most memorable class sessions in their undergraduate careers. Like, I wanted to give them something to remember, you know? And then we'll have, during the class, we'll have a sort of, you know, I'll be in conversation with the two actors talking about the game and about understanding the game as a piece of historical recreation, kind of what work they put into it, how they feel about it as a piece of, history. And we'll save time for autographs and selfies and all this kind of thing. I'm so sure the students would love it, you know.
Is this the last class before spring break?
It is.
Yeah, that's
so cool. I'm a little anxious that attendance might be lower because, you know, students like to jet out a little early and get started.
Get on the road to Panama City.
Yeah, exactly. It's a long drive.
Yeah.
So I'm going to like put into place all kinds of like carrots and sticks, you know, like we're going to have two quizzes on this day. We're going to be, you have to be here. Attendance is vital.
Yeah.
So, you know, hopefully I get lost in them to show up, but then, you know, if they miss, imagine that student who's like the gamer who does drive down to Panama City earlier and comes back and they're like, yeah, Arthur Morgan and John Marston were in class on Thursday. You missed it.
Oh,
it
man.
Would feel so bad.
That is so cool of you to want to do that for your kids. Students, we call them, not kids, right? I've been told that at the university, you can't refer to them as kids because they are fully grown adults.
They are.
But it's cool that you would want to do that for them. It's cool that those two actors would do it too.
They love the idea. Yeah.
I bet they do. Because, I mean, they have they're obviously very well known. But to have like a distilled version of your fanship, that people that have committed so hard to, you know, to spend their, you know, these kids are taking out student loans to take these classes and they'll be paying them back for a little while.
Yeah.
And I think that hopefully it's not lost on them what a great honor it is for those kids to be in that room too. Yeah. Students.
Yeah. I think one of the reasons that, I mean, I hate putting words in their mouth or in their head, but I think one of the reasons the actors, Rob and Roger, were so enthused and excited about the idea was that I don't imagine they get invited to college campuses all that often. I mean, they go all over the place and travel for events and signings and photo ops and all this. But I think that, you know, the fact that this is a serious college class gives them a little bit of intellectual gravitas, which I think they deserve always. I mean,
sure.
They're incredible actors. They do amazing work.
Yeah, but this isn't Comic-Con. You know,
exactly.
This is a different crowd.
Well, funny that you mentioned that. The main reason I'm able to pull this off is because they're coming to Knoxville already for the Fanboy Expo, which takes place during spring break, the first weekend.
Nice.
So when I saw that they were coming, I was like, you know, I got to strike immediately. And you know, like, hey guys, can you come 2 days early and, you know, make a surprise visit to a class? And they were all excited about it.
Yeah. Well, those, you know, Fanboy Expo, Comic-Con, all that stuff. Those are fanatics, right?
Oh yeah.
So, you know, that's, you know, what these guys are going to have a heck of a weekend. I'll tell you that. They really will. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's so exciting, man. I actually pre-ordered the audio version, I believe.
Oh, thanks.
Of the book. So.
Well, you made the right move because Roger's voice is going to do it wonders.
Yeah. And I don't know if that had been, if that deal had been made yet. So I just kind of got lucky.
You're ahead of the curve, Ben, as you often are.
Yeah. Well, I'll put down in the show notes, maybe a link to the, to where you can pre-order. Can you still pre-order it?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's only $20 for the audio, which is great. It's cheaper than the book.
Yeah. Well, I you know, before we wrap up, I do want to know if you have any grand and crazy visions for the future at the university, or what your next, other than finishing the country.
Yeah, well, country book, I'm really on the fence now, because like I had this great research for the country music book, and I'm eager to return to it, but if Red Dad's History does really well and kind of gets me into new conversations and gets publicity, I could see myself writing about video games for a while to come. Well, and I have other ideas for, you know, continuing the momentum from this book. Because, of course, there are many other historical video games that are interesting to write about and to think about, aside from the Red Dead Redemption series.
Well, it's an interesting, you know, the Venn diagram, the crossover on it is interesting. And the fact that you are... so deeply interested in both sides of it, really. I mean, niches are, you know, are what they are for, you know, a reason. They're small little pockets that can, you know, sometimes have, you know, really, really prolific impact across the board. So yeah, I can see how you might have stumbled on a little something that fills, you know, two things that you're very interested in, and nobody on the planet is better at, could be better at putting those two things together. You might be the best at it. Who knows?
Maybe. Or maybe this thing will be a total flop that'll get me laughed out of the academy in addition to the regular world. But you know, I'm still hopeful about it. And yeah, well, I'll kind of see how things go. But I'm really, I had a lot, like I mentioned before, you know, I had a lot of fun writing this book, and I'm really eager to kind of hit the promotional circuit and go on podcasts, mm-hmm. go on people's streaming channels on Twitch and YouTube, and, you know, to get in with like the gamers, because there's so many of them online and they're talking about all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. Not all of it's brilliant, right?
Yeah.
But there's a lot of smart people in gaming. There's a lot of smart people who are thirsty and hungry for ideas, and, you know, if you take them seriously, like meet them where they're at and, you know, respect their passions, but then take them to newer levels. I think there's a lot of people excited about that. That's my hope, at least.
Yeah.
That's always been my hope with this.
Well, maybe these kids will trick their parents into, you know, like you did with yours with a PC, you know, they're like, look, Mom, I'm reading a book.
That's right. Yeah. That's the hope.
I guess I do have one more question. We stumbled. I feel like, back when we were neighbors, I'd been a Grateful Dead fan for quite some time, and then you rolled up on me one day and was like, I finally listened to him, absolutely love it, and you kind of did you gave it the historian's treatment and dug in really deep. I remember you asked me, you were like, okay, so what's your favorite show? And I was like, well, I think it's probably you know, thinking I was being all, you know, yeah, fanboy. I was like, you know, I think, you know, it's probably May 8th. It's my birthday date. You know, May 8th, 1990 or 1977. You're like, oh, the Cornell show? Everybody knows that show. I was like, damn it. Tori.
How expected.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course it is.
Cornell 77? Like, yeah, oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody knows that one. I was like, you've only been obsessed with this band for like 2 months and you already know their catalog better than
I know. But I had like the, you know, the, got to enjoy all the internet profiles that, you know, maybe hadn't blossomed as much when you were getting into it.
Yeah.
But no, I was a late blooming Deadhead, but I still love the band.
Yeah. Is there anything that could ever happen there with you, with your historical prowess and your love of that band that could pop up and bear some fruit somewhere?
Yeah, that's a good question. The closest I've gotten is looking at a number of the country singers who the Dead covers, you know, like Marty Robbins with El Paso, and they cover Merle Haggard a good bit, right? Mama Tried. Yeah. But no, I've never thought about writing about a rock band in historical context.
Well, that one's been written about plenty, so it might be a crowded space for you.
You think there's books about the Grateful Dead? Just a couple.
Yeah, I don't know. You found a way to teach a college, a 300-level course on a video game. You're obviously pretty resourceful. You might be able to uncover a little rock that nobody knows about. Who knows?
Totally. I mean, the Dead are another institution that replicates itself every year. You know, there's new fans that come in. They don't need an advertising budget to grow their ranks.
No.
Even as the older generation dies off, the new ranks are coming in. That's for sure.
Well, Tori, I really appreciate you coming. This has been, for me, a long time coming. I very rarely get to speak with academics who are, who just have such a breadth of knowledge, and it's been great to listen to you. I could listen to you for hours,
and I could chat with you for many hours. This has been a total blast.
Yeah.
I'm so thrilled and honored that you'd have me on South of Scruffy.
Of course, man. I would love to have you back sometime. Maybe after the book comes out, and we can dig into some other topics.
Let's do it.
Because you know about them. I know you do.
Something, not much, but some.
Well, it's great to see you, and I really appreciate you doing it.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.